It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 2005, Alan Johnson lost his father. In the years that followed, the question of what to do with his father's remains grew in his mind and launched him on a journey of discovery that brought him to the Midwest. He's written about that journey in the memoir Not From Here, and he is with me today. Hello, Alan.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Now, back in 2005, when your father passed away, this was not an unexpected death. This was something that you saw coming. So you did, you tried to make some plans with him, right?
I did, and part of it was asking him where would he like his ashes to be placed after he's died. And he shrugged and he said, I don't care. He said, it makes no difference to me at all.
When he said that, what was your immediate response?
I wasn't particularly surprised. My father had traveled all over the world. He'd lived in many places in the world. He'd spent much of his adult career in the U.S. Foreign Service. He spoke 3-4 languages fluently, including Norwegian, which was the language of his lineage, so that it didn't strike me as strange that he wouldn't have a strong opinion about that. The problem was, as years went by and I still had this little box with his ashes in it, and realized I didn't know what to do with them, even though I felt obliged to do something and something meaningful with them. But and as I thought about that question, I also became aware that I didn't know how to answer that question for myself. If my children were to ask me, where do you belong? Where do your remains belong? I wouldn't know what to tell them, which is what prompted this journey.
As that question grew in your mind, you've written, of course, an entire book about this journey, but could you read for us just a little bit of some of the questions that did grow over time for you?
Well, I'll read you a portion where I am essentially addressing my father, who is no longer alive, and saying to him what I wish he had said to me when I asked him the question. I do not understand how could you could be close enough to death to see it coming and hear your son ask such a question, setting up one of those unforgettable moments out of which comes a story passed down across generations. I'll never forget the day I asked your great-grandfather where he wanted his ashes to be spread, how he looked at me for the longest time before he spoke. How you could hear such a thing and manage only a shrug and what you said. I have seen you show more interest in a piece of lemon meringue pie than what I saw in your face that day. But you may not have known what I was really asking. Even so, I find it hard to understand. Yes, I know, I didn't know what I was asking either, but you were the father, and fathers are supposed to know such things. You were supposed to look me in the eye as if it wasn't you at all, but some ancestral presence coming through, a voice of wisdom that surprised even you, not knowing it was there until just this moment had arrived, the singular moment of passing on. Here is who you are, no mere extension of me, but of the same stuff that I am of, from the same place where I am going now and where you will follow in your time. And when I am gone, you will take me there, and you will know what it is.
Did you find yourself feeling angry that he didn't give you an answer?
A little bit, not a lot, because after all, I could have followed up my question. I could have said, well, you know, what do you mean you don't care? And I didn't. And that was my choice. He answered me as I think he simply answered me truthfully. And candidly. And so in a sense, I have no one to blame but myself that he hadn't done that. I wish it had occurred to him, of course, but I don't think I felt angry. I felt, as time went on, I felt a bit lost not having some guidance to go by.
For so many of us, I think there's an obvious place. If we didn't give our children an answer, they would think, well, you know, this is the place where they seemed most at home, or the place that they loved, or the place that they told people they were from. Why was that so difficult with your father?
I think it was difficult for the same reason that it was difficult for me in terms of that question applied to me. It all it all hinges on how the word from is interpreted. What does it mean to be from someplace? And that typically that means where were you born, or it means where do you live currently. And that, of course, it's true. It's, so I'm from Connecticut right now. I'm from Washington, D.C., in the sense that I was born there. But the kind of from that I confronted on this 2,000-mile road trip with my dad's ashes had to do with land. It had to do with identifying with a people who define themselves in part in relation to a particular place. And my father was essentially saying to me that he didn't need that. Now, I'll never know what he really meant. But the challenge for me then became, what people am I a part of that are identified, defined in terms of their relation to a particular place? And I couldn't, that's what I wound up actually searching for that. As much as I was fulfilling an obligation to my father, I was also, in some ways even more so, I was trying to find that place where I belonged.
In the years that followed your father's death, you had these ashes that you knew you needed to do something with, but you and your siblings had also placed some of his ashes in other places. Why wasn't that enough for you? Why not distribute all of his ashes instead of keeping some in reserve for this big question?
That's an interesting question, Charity. I'm not sure why I hung on to mine and didn't just dispose of them in some way. Sometimes I think that even if my father wasn't aware of it, sometimes I think this is what was happening when he said he didn't care, was that he was handing that question back to me. He was saying, I don't need anything in particular around where my ashes are, for whatever reasons he had for saying that. But in some ways, I feel like he was handing that question to me and saying, but there's something here you need to find out for yourself.
Did you need to do something for your father? Was this an act that you feel resolved your relationship in some way?
In some way, yes, in the sense that I feel that I did the best with what I was given to work with. I have mixed feelings about where I left my father's ashes. I don't think it was a mistake. I don't think it was the wrong place. But I do think it wasn't the place I was hoping to find. I was hoping to find a place that actually somehow sent me the message, this is where he belongs. And I feel I got as close as I could get to such a place, but didn't actually find it. And I felt certainly some closure around that. I feel that I did well by my father, given what he gave me to work with. I feel I did as well as I could. But I came home, and since then I've been keenly aware of how much is lacking in that solution, not only for him, but even more so for me.
Now, you mentioned Norway. Your father was the child of Norwegian immigrants to the United States, or the grandchild of Norwegian immigrants to the United States. And he actually returned to Norway as an adult himself. You lived in Norway as a child for a time. And your father was proud of being Norwegian. Why wasn't that the direction that you turned? I mean, I can imagine some beautiful fjords, a wonderful place to sprinkle your father's ashes.
I that makes perfect sense. And I of course, I thought about that. And the reason that I did not take my dad's ashes to Norway, first of all, was that he didn't ask me to. If he had said, I want to be in Hardangerfjord, I wouldn't have hesitated a moment before taking him there. And he took us back as adults to visit our relatives in Bergen. And we, as part of that, we took a trip up Hardangerfjord, which was the only time I'd ever seen it. But he didn't ask for that. And so then the second thing became my growing awareness that I wanted to find a place where both of us belonged. It seemed bizarre to me that a father would belong someplace where the children would not. When in fact, of course, that's the story of pretty much everyone in North America who isn't Native American. If we go back in our lineages a number of generations, we will find this disconnect where everybody from there back belongs someplace else, and everybody from there forward doesn't belong anywhere.
Right. We are a nation of immigrants.
We are, and I think that also means that we're a nation of displaced people going back for generation after generation. So I realized that I think I had a hard time accepting that somehow my dad would belong in a place that I didn't. It seemed wrong. And so I think I held out some hope that somehow out there on the prairie, I was going to come up upon some place. And however such messages get conveyed, I was going to know in my bones, this is it.
So you bought yourself some maps. You got a map of South Dakota, and that's where your father spent some of his childhood, right?
High school,
okay. You bought a map of Minnesota, and you bought a map of Iowa, and you started to look around at some of your ancestral homes in these places where your great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, settled when they came from Norway. Did you feel a pull to this part of the country?
I felt a pull in the sense that it was as close as I had ever gotten to places where my family's history on my father's side certainly had played out. So I worked my way backwards. South Dakota was where my dad finished up his growing up. I worked back into Minnesota where he was born, and then I worked, the last part of the trip was in Iowa, where his father was born and where his great-grandparents settled after emigrating from Norway. And I would say that, well, two things about this, how I felt about this. One was that I had repeated experiences of being deeply moved and also being disappointed.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Alan Johnson. His latest memoir is Not From Here. It's about the journey that he took. It brought him to Iowa, to Minnesota, to South Dakota, in search of a place to leave his father's remains. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today is Alan Johnson. He is the author of the new memoir, Not From Here. It's a book about how he went on a journey to find a place to leave his father's remains about 3 years after his father's death. And it brought him to Minnesota, to South Dakota, and to Iowa. And Alan, I mentioned before the break that you purchased maps of these three states, and we're starting to think about planning a trip here. I'd love for you to read a little bit about what you saw when you started looking at these maps.
Mm-hmm. I look at my maps of Iowa, Minnesota, and South Dakota, land soaked in blood, spilled and taking it away from peoples who had lived on it for thousands of years and wanted only to go on as before. I have not been searching for that history, which came up briefly and almost by accident. I have been looking for a link between myself and what I imagine to be the land of my ancestors, the people of my origin, wanting to imagine, needing to. D. Brown writes that the Indians knew that life was equated with the earth, which I think means you cannot understand a life without knowing the land it came from and where it was lived, because the two are one and the same. But I grew up in a society that looks upon land as a temporary place to live, to set up shop, a resource to be seized and controlled and exploited, ruined if need be, in pursuit of wealth and power. The last thing that would occur to us is to look upon the land and see ourselves, or to look deep into our own eyes, our faces, the lines that etch our lives upon our bodies, and see the land. I am a white man, born and raised, the land therefore a mystery to me, making me a mystery to myself. And if native people are right about the land, then it is not a sort of mystery to be solved like an engineering problem, but instead something that can be known only through the body, and for that the body must be on the land. What I know about my ancestors and the land has come mostly through books, without the urgency that I am feeling now in these days before I set out on this journey in the middle of my 63rd year, in a way I never would have imagined, through the body of my father.
Alan Johnson reading from his memoir, Not From Here. And Alan, when you read that, it strikes me that as someone who grew up in Iowa and whose family has been in Iowa for a long time, I know a lot of people who live on Century Farms and their families have been on this land for a long time. A lot of people feel a very, very deep connection to the land that their fathers and their forefathers and their mothers and their foremothers have farmed for generations. You, as your the title of the book says, you're not from here. Did you delve into that kind of connection as well? I mean, I understand where you're going with talking about the people who had this land before the settlers came, but a lot of people would say there is a deep connection.
I think there certainly is. I would never deny that there is. I think what I confronted on this trip was that there are different kinds of deep connections. There is the deep connection that you talk about that is certainly very real, but I also think there is the deep connection that comes with being part of a people who identify a place as their origin. So that for the people who live in the United States to say that the land of the United States is the land of the origin of their people, where their people came from in some original sense, we can't say that unless we're Native Americans.
You have devoted a lot of your career to trying to understand white privilege in this country. And that research, that work that you've done, made this kind of journey much more complicated for you than I think it would have been for a lot of people.
Yes, it was, because I had to realize the way in which what otherwise would have been my personal story or my dad's personal story, the way in which those stories are embedded in much larger stories. So that for me to look to my lineage, for example, for some sense of who I am, for me to look at the relationship between my great-grandparents and the land that they settled on and raised a family on, for me to look to that land to somehow tell me something about who I am, I have to realize that I'm also looking at land that has a history, and it's a terrible history in terms of what was done to make that land available to my great-grandparents and all the benefits that came after that in the generations that followed. So it makes it tremendously complicated for me, and I think for all of us, to arrive at some sense of feeling good, for example, about our lineage. Because it's a mixed picture. If we embrace the entire story of this country, then we have to embrace both the horror along with the things that we're proud of.
You find yourself parsing your language a lot when you talk about we took this land away from the Native Americans, wondering why you include yourself in that. You clearly feel a sense of responsibility, although you weren't there. You weren't making those decisions.
I feel a sense of responsibility, Charity, I think, because being a citizen of this country, first of all, I think requires us to take responsibility for the continuation of things that we had nothing to do with. So I feel responsible, for example, for attending to the Constitution of the United States, even though that was written hundreds of years ago and I had nothing to do with it, and yet it's not simply a matter of history. I feel a certain responsibility to the revolution in the United States, even though it was a long time ago and I had nothing to do with it, but there's a way in which it continues, and it's the continuing nature of these things that makes the country what it is. And so as a current member of this society, I have a responsibility to attend to those things, even though I had nothing to do with them, because the past is not simply in the past. I also feel a responsibility to my ancestors. I feel a responsibility to do what I can to set right what was done. Whether they did it personally or not, I don't know. I'm never going to know. But I have to assume that there was at least the complicity of silence. I feel an ongoing responsibility to my ancestors to be aware of where they came from, to be aware of the choices that they made, all of which have made my life possible, and then to turn toward the future and ask myself the question, so what am I going to do in response to this history that continues now into the present? What's my obligation to them to make things right by them? So I feel both those kinds of responsibility for things that I have never done. I don't feel ashamed for the history of the United States. I don't feel guilty about it because I didn't do any of these things. But I do feel a profound sense of responsibility, which I think is very different from guilt and shame.
As you traveled, particularly in South Dakota, you had an opportunity, as everyone who travels in that part of the country does, to learn more about Native American history and Native American culture. And you write about even feeling conflicted there. I mean, this is something that you care about, that you wanted to know more about. But just because you are a white man, you almost felt like it wasn't your right to explore that history. That's the sense that I got. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's my right to explore it, but I felt an increasing sense of not having a right to be on the land that I was on. That's part of the difficulty of living in a land where you don't belong. And at first, I moved with a great deal of ease, which is what I'm used to doing as a white man in this country. I didn't expect anyone to stop me, to challenge my being there. I felt I have a perfect right to go anywhere I want and not be greeted with suspicion, much less hostility. But as I became more aware, beginning quite early on in the trip in Minnesota, as I became aware of the history that much of which I already knew, but as it became foremost in my mind, in terms of the land that I was traveling over, I felt an increasing sense of displacement, that I was from somewhere else and it wasn't here. I felt it especially when I was on Native American reservations, which was at a couple points in my travels I was. And each time I felt this sense of trespass, that they would just assume that I wasn't there.
And although you didn't have any negative responses to your presence.
No, I had no negative responses to my presence at all.
This was all a struggle within you.
This was a struggle within me, yes.
And it seemed to be nearly paralyzing.
Oh, I don't think it was paralyzing. I mean, I did continue on. But it was, I felt, in those moments, for example, I went into a casino in the reservation near Watertown, South Dakota. And everyone was very nice to me. And the place was full of white people, because I think, you know, the white people are probably the major clientele for these casinos, is my guess. But I also felt that I was on some level I was being tolerated. They had me there because they didn't have any other choice economically. That was the feeling I had, and no one communicated that to me. And so I wanted to leave, and I did. So it wasn't paralyzing in that sense, but it made me very quiet. It was a lesson in humility. That's certainly true. Which for a white person in North America in relation to people of color is not a typical experience. But that was my experience, that I was a visitor and that I ought to behave like one.
You mentioned that you sort of went backwards chronologically, visiting South Dakota first and then spending time in Minnesota and in Iowa and going further back in your family's history.
Yes.
Where they settled when they came to the United States from Norway. And you also found family along the way. You still have family in Minnesota. You still have family in Iowa. And these were parts of your family that you really hadn't had much contact with before, right?
That's correct, yeah.
How did that feel to come to this part of the country where you'd visited a few times, but for work? Mm-hmm. Here you were, and then you found these family connections. What did that feel like to meet people that were part of your past and your future, even though you didn't know them?
It was It was a mixture of things, and it was deeply moving. It was I felt sad about it in many ways. It was deeply moving because they were all so kind to me, especially in Iowa, where I spent the most time. Very generous in their giving their time and helping me to find out things I needed to know. Going through my great grandparents' house, the farmhouse, for example, in Thor, was one of the most moving things I did. None of which I could have done without their being so welcoming to me. At the same time, I could not help but feel a sense of sadness in that their expressed connection to our great grandparents was much stronger and much easier than my own. And I wished I had that for myself. I wished I had a stronger sense of connection to my ancestors, because although that's not the same thing as being on the land that I belong to, it sure helps. And I could really feel the absence of that. One of the ways I became acutely aware of this was I was trying to do the family tree thing, mm-hmm. and encountered the term second cousin or second cousin once removed, all of that. I didn't know what those words meant. And so I went and asked people, what do those words mean? And they didn't know what they meant either. And I realized that it wasn't just a technical thing of knowing the vocabulary, that it reflected something deeper, that I lacked a sense of continuity. I lacked a sense of origins, a sense of rootedness going back so many generations. It wasn't part of my active awareness. And when I tried to assemble the family tree, that's when I became aware of how cut off I was from any deep sense of that going back any more than, you know, a generation or two.
One of the scenes in the book finds you sitting at your great-great-grandparents' graves. Mm-hmm. And you weep when you're there. Do you know why? Why were you so moved by being in that place?
I think I've thought about that a lot, Charity, and I think that I felt like I was getting as close as I was going to get to this thing I felt such longing for, which was to belong. In a fundamental way. I mean, I belong in lots of ways. I belong in my family. I belong in my community. So I'm not, a stranger to the feeling of belonging. But this was the kind of belonging that I didn't even know existed until this conversation with my father set this in motion. And to sit in that little cemetery, which is like an island out in the middle of, you know, miles and miles of cornfields, to sit between my grandparents, my great-grandparents, and other kin was so moving to me. I spoke to them. I'm frankly, it's a little hard for me to talk right now, but I introduced myself. I said, "You don't know me. This is Alan, your great-grandson." And I felt that I was in the company of these people in some way. As I said before, I was as close as I was going to get to such a thing. And that's why it was so moving to me.
And that's how you found a place to leave your father. And you returned home to your life, to the land that you live on now, a beautiful place that you and your wife have built together. In returning home, how has this experience changed you?
I think it has opened me to the question of who am I? And who are we, in a way that I wasn't opened to it before. I don't have some nice answer to this profound question. There was no epiphany that made everything right. It isn't right. I think that being a white person in North America, just this is part of what comes with it, is this absence. At the same time, I'm aware that I'm still here, and I have a life to live, and I am living it. But I'm living it with certain questions that accompany me. And I have no idea where that's going to take me. In the same way that when I got in that rental car in St. Paul, I had no idea what this was going to turn out to be. And I realized that when I got off the plane at home, I wasn't done. And my sense is that as a country, we are not done with this. This question of where do we belong? And I think that it's vital that we stay on that journey, wherever it takes us.
Alan Johnson, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity.
Alan Johnson, his memoir is Not From Here. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The question of what to do with the remains of a loved one is something that almost all of us have to face at some point. And the decisions, sometimes made very quickly, are final. Cremation is not reversible. Grave markers are often literally carved in stone. Mercedes Byrne Klug is the director of the Aging Studies Program at the University of Iowa, and she is here with me today. Mercedes, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in this day and age, of course, people have always had to make these decisions. But in this day and age, it seems like there are more options than ever available to people. Do you feel like there's been sort of an explosion in the things that people can do?
Absolutely. There are a lot of options that people can do privately and publicly. Privately, we've always had special ways to remember our loved ones. A lock of hair, a special poem, a bookmark. And then publicly, in many traditions, it's been through cemeteries. Those exist and continue to be very important parts of the community. But we also now have this whole cyber world that's out there where people can post a memory there. And then a new tradition of using the cremated remains as part of jewelry. So there are lockets, there's earrings, there's artwork that people have made with cremated remains. And then people have put up benches, people have donated wings to libraries. I mean, part of memorialization is meaning making and what a person's life has meant to the community or to the family or to one special person. And so there are very many different ways to memorialize some that you love. And in fact, some of the memorialization occurs by the person before he or she dies. They decide in part what kind of a memory they'd like to leave. And so they might donate money or time or let it be known, you know, what would be something that would please them in terms of being remembered.
Well, and you train social workers, and of course a lot of social workers work with people and their families when they come to the end of life. Do you encourage the people that you work with to encourage other people to make these decisions before it's too late, before they die?
Well, memorialization's a little bit different than actually having to make the final arrangements. So the final arrangement decisions are the decisions about what happens to the body. So there's a limited amount of time you have to make those decisions once a person has died. So any conversations that can happen ahead of time, those are so important. Memorialization's a little bit different. You don't have to feel rushed into doing this. And that would be one of the main points that I'd send to your listeners, is that people can take time to think about something that really is truly meaningful for them. There's not a big rush. And so in some traditions, there's a automatic wait of a year before you put the final grave marker down. And there are temporary grave markers that any funeral director or cemetery can get for a family while they make these decisions and while they think about this. And there are always different ways that you can memorialize somebody that you love through, you know, donating time or money in their name. And so all the decisions don't have to be made at once. And people can do more than one way or more than one thing to memorialize their loved one.
On the subject of final arrangements, though, those are decisions that do have to be made pretty quickly after someone dies. And it seems to me that there's a lot of pressure on the people who are left behind to make those decisions. What kind of guidance can you give people when they're suddenly in that situation where a loved one has died and maybe not left a plan behind, and all of a sudden they're facing the funeral industry and they have to decide what to do? They're going to be spending a lot of money. For some people, you know, spending $6,000 is a huge investment, and all of a sudden they're making decisions that will cost that much money in the span of a couple of days. And of course, it could be much, much more expensive than that.
It's helpful to have these conversations ahead of time. Most people don't. Most families don't. And it also depends where you live and what kind of a community you're in. Because some religious groups have a pretty pat-down way of doing final arrangements. So if you're part of that religious group, you know you just go along with that. They'll even have the specific providers that they work through. Other people will have to make decisions from scratch from the very beginning in terms of what kind of a ceremony do we want to have? Will the body be cremated, donated, entombed in a mausoleum or buried? There are a lot of decisions. So if the person who died has died unexpectedly, then you might want to take a deep breath and think about what your options are and know that there is information that can help people understand what those options are. And if you mention to your funeral director that you have a certain budget or there are certain things you need to watch out for, most funeral directors are going to want to make you happy. Word of mouth is very important, and people need to just speak up. The other piece of advice I have is that if you're in the position of making final arrangements for somebody who's lived 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years, and no time in that span they mention to you what they would like, give yourself permission to do what you would like, because there has been plenty of time for people to say what they wanted. And if they didn't say what they wanted, then don't beat yourself up about doing, you know, if you don't know, you don't know.
Your students have done some research about costs of funeral services or costs of final arrangements and looked at the different cost structures at different funeral homes around the state of Iowa in different communities. And they found a lot of disparity from funeral home to funeral home, which also makes this a difficult process. I mean, would you recommend shopping around, which would be a very difficult thing to do at that time?
I would absolutely check prices and check options. It's not just the money amount. It's also the options. So as a consumer, it would be helpful to have a few givens. And by that, I mean, are you planning on having the person buried, their body buried, or is a person planning on being cremated? Because once one of those decisions are made, then what happens with the buried body is pretty straightforward, either under the ground or above the ground. If a person's cremated, you have a lot more options. And so you have to have a few givens to get started. But absolutely, you can call around. The Federal Trade Commission requires that funeral homes give anybody who asks for it a copy of their what's called a general price list. And that is required by law. You can walk in any funeral home in the country and ask for a copy of that. You can ask for an appointment with the funeral director and talk with them. Talk with somebody from your spiritual community. Offer to go along with somebody else when they have a death in their family and they're looking for someone to go with them. And then ask questions.
Now, we talked a little bit about memorialization earlier, and you mentioned that there is a lot more time when you're thinking about a permanent memorial for a loved one. I can imagine that makes some of those decisions really difficult, too, because now there's no deadline. You have a lot of time to think about something, which is nice, but the options seem to be, again, exploding along those lines.
Lots of options. I'm in the School of Social Work, and we work with to help prepare our students to work with people on lots of issues related to grief and loss. And coming up with a way to memorialize a loved one can be a very effective and therapeutic way to begin to come to terms with the loss. Not that people will ever fully get used to life without that person, but there are ways to try to add some meaning to the loss and meaning to the life by how the person is remembered. And some people do that by donating organs. I mean, something as practical as that, and we need organs all over the United States. Other people will do it through writing, you know, a poem, a journal entry. Some kind of expressive art can be so therapeutic. How they deal with the belongings of the person who died, how, you know, what they give to somebody else, or just the uses of what that person did with their life can be so meaningful. And it's not always clear right away what would be a good way to memorialize somebody. And people can also take some pressure off themselves by realizing you can memorialize people in many ways. There doesn't have to be just one way. And in the past, it's been in large part through the grave markers at the cemetery. And that still is very important for many people. But as you mentioned at the top of the show, there are lots of options.
Well, and cremation is more popular than ever, but also the way that we live today. We move around so much more often that the question of where someone should be buried is probably a difficult question for a lot of people if there haven't already been funeral plots or burial plots that have been purchased.
Charity, you've brought up something practically uniquely American, because we move around more than most other countries on earth. And so the issue of where a person would be buried comes up in the United States in a way that it just doesn't in so many other parts of the world.
Well, and of course, there are more options there today, because it used to be that when you died, you needed to be buried fairly quickly, so you would be buried
right where you were. Yes.
And it's interesting. I spent my entire life in the Midwest. Our cemeteries in the Midwest are different than cemeteries, not just around the rest of the world, but even in different parts of the country, aren't they?
That's right. John Gary Brown wrote a book that was published by the University of Kansas Press. And in that book, he talks about how when you go to cemeteries in small towns in middle America, you see a cross-section of the town in a way that you wouldn't see in a larger area or areas in the East Coast or in Europe, where people were buried more as part of their religious community. But here in the Midwest, when we first started settling towns and developing cemeteries, it was a cross-section of the population. And so for people who enjoy going to cemeteries or doing grave rubbings or things like that, the Midwest has got a special lure, because you can see so many different kinds of grave markers and so many different kinds of people in the same location.
Now, we talked earlier about encouraging people to make sure that their preferences are known before they die. But also, on the flip side, do you encourage people to ask? That can be a difficult conversation to have, because, of course, you're admitting that someone's life is going to come to an end. But is it important to say, you know, Mom, where is home to you? Where do you want to be?
I think it's important to have these conversations, and it'd be easier to have these conversations if our society and our culture was set up to socially sanction these conversations. So if in some families, they might deliberately have these conversations on Memorial Day weekend, sometime during that weekend when people are getting together and then just talking about, well, you know, when it comes my time, this is what I would like. Another time for people who are Christian would be at the end of October, the beginning of November, All Saints Day, All Souls Day is a traditional time in the Christian religion to be talking about times of death and dying. So that'd be a natural time. You know, the other thing is, and most people don't say it, but I'm just going to say it, if it really doesn't matter to you, then go ahead and say it really doesn't matter to me, so that people aren't tripping over themselves trying to figure out what it is that could, you know, that would honor you or please you. But if you say it really doesn't matter, that's not always that helpful. So if you can give people a couple little hints or give them something that they can do on your behalf, even if it's small, that can really bring a sense of closure, an important sense of closure. I did a study about a decade ago, and one of the persons that was in the study mentioned that his wife had always told him she wanted to be entombed in this certain cemetery in Boston. And so all their married life, 40 years, he said, sure, sure, when it's your time, that's where you'll be. And then she died. And then he went to that cemetery and he could not afford to have her entombed there. And yet he had promised for all these years. And so be careful what you ask for and be careful what you agree to. And finding something small and meaningful is a good place to start.
And if that conversation is too difficult to have, do you have any ways that you would recommend that people might want to leave the information somewhere where their loved ones could find it?
Sure. The issue about final arrangements, though, often people might not find your wishes until after those decisions have been made. I think that was the case.
Then there could be a lot of regrets.
There could be. And so I think it's always useful to say, if it works out, this is what I'd prefer, because so many different things can happen. But even I think it was FDR who had left very detailed wishes about where his final resting place would be and things like that. But people didn't get their hands on that until after it was all over and he was already buried. So there are some subtle ways to bring it up. You can always mention somebody else's grave marker, or when you're going past a cemetery saying, oh, I'd like that for myself, or I wouldn't like that for myself. How about you? You know, there's some subtle ways to bring it up. And none of us knows when our time is up. So regardless of your age, you can start talking about what your preferences would be or whether or not it's important to you. And there may be other ways that you'd like to be remembered or honored.
Mercedes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mercedes Byrne Klug is the director of the Aging Studies Program at the University of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime. Our address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.